word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
For word of mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, it's time for the annual round of lofty hopes and moving tales of overcoming the odds, the commencement speech.
As Teddy Roosevelt said, the credit belongs to the man in the arena whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood.
Now, the early American naval commander John Paul Jones said, if fear is cultivated, it will become stronger. If faith is cultivated...
You receive a steady stream of sensationalism and scandal and stories with a message that suggests change isn't possible, that you can't make a difference, that you won't be able to close that gap between life as it is and life as you want it to be. My job today is to tell you don't believe it.
Inspiring words there from Katie Couric at Case Western Reserve in 2010, Tom Hanks at Yale in 2011, and President Obama addressing Barnard graduates on Monday of this week. Charles Whelan veered off the motivational script when addressing the 2011 class at Dartmouth, telling the graduates, your worst days lie ahead. Now, he's written a book, Assembling 10 and a Half Things No Commencement Speaker Has Ever Said. He teaches at Dartmouth and the University of Chicago and joins us now from WBEZ in Chicago. Charles Whelan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Your worst days lie ahead. Did you not read 10 Tips for Inspiring Commencement Speeches?
I did not, and maybe that's why I went with the news that they actually wanted to hear. Everybody who reads that excerpt says the students must have been mortified, they must have been unhappy. And in fact, that was one of the most popular points in the original speech on which this book was based. And the reason is everybody talks about success. Commencement speakers are about successful people talking about doing successful things. And I think for a lot of students, they look out and say, look, I don't feel like I'm commander of the world at the moment. And it is very encouraging to know that a few rough patches along the way are just okay. And in fact, they're normal.
And in fact, on the cover of your book, there are graduates. It is a brilliant illustration by the New Yorker cartoonist Peter Steiner on the cover and throughout the book. They're shocked. They look terrified, the graduates. How was your speech received? Did people look shocked?
Shocked at first. The very first point in the speech and in the book was your time spent in fraternity basements was well spent. And the president of Dartmouth was behind me. I think he shifted uncomfortably in his seat. And the students were like, wow, this really isn't going to be like most speeches. But overall, it went over extremely well because it was, I think, perceived as refreshing. And I think one important back note on the speech in the book is that my first job out of college was writing speeches for Governor John R. McKernan in Maine, now most famous for being Olympia Snowe's husband. Mm-hmm. And I was writing those kind of conventional speeches. I didn't read the how-to guide because there was no internet. I would have. And I think at age 23, I wrote a lot of very conventional, somewhat banal talks. When you fast forward 23 years later, and I was addressing not only students, but students at my alma mater, I felt like I owed them something more candid and thoughtful.
Was your time in fraternity basements well spent?
Well, it's meant to be a metaphor, as I point out quite explicitly, for all of your engagement with other people. So it's playing Frisbee, it's sitting on the green, it's just talking about useless things with people. And the point is that this ties together some of the work that I've been involved with as a public policy person ever since. We now study happiness, and we know the most important thing in terms of determining your well-being is engagement with other people. So the point here is you shouldn't feel guilty about the time when you're not working, either in school or beyond school, because those are the relationships that really determine your quality of life ever after.
You weren't actually the speaker for Dartmouth's 2011 class. That was Conan O'Brien. Now here's just a clip from his address.
But don't get me wrong, I take my task today very seriously. When I got the call 2 months ago to be your speaker, I decided to prepare with the same intensity many of you have devoted to an important term paper. So late last night, I began. I drank 2 cans of Red Bull, snorted some Adderall, played a few hours of Call of Duty, and then opened my browser. I think Wikipedia put it best when they said Dartmouth College is a private Ivy League university in Hanover, New Hampshire, United States. Thank you and good luck.
So you were just the warm-up act, Charles.
I was literally the warm-up act for Conan. I was the day before, at what's called Class Day, and that's actually a more intimate event. It's just the students, some parents. It's informal, but it's a little bit more special in the sense that it's just the class and they get to pick their speaker. They pick one faculty member, one member of the class. And so it's kind of like you're sharing a special experience before you go out and do all the pomp and circumstance the next day.
So they chose you. And, you know, Conan seemed to be keeping it real. Is this a sort of trend? I mean, I'm preparing for this. I listened to a number of different commencement speeches. And the Stephen Colberts, the Jon Stewarts, those who have a sort of lighthearted message seem to be a lot more popular these days.
I think there's an appreciation that there's not a contradiction between being lighthearted, farcical, funny, and being deadly serious in terms of content. I mean, if you think about the Jon Stewarts and Colberts of the world, some of the news they're delivering on a daily basis is actually quite serious. It's got a very serious message. It actually has an interesting editorial spin on the world. So it's a relatively new phenomenon, I think, that people can enjoy a little more levity without compromising the fact that, hey, there's still actually some serious substance here.
Let's go through a couple more points. I like number 7.5. Your parents don't want what is best for you. Yeah, you're right. I would never hear that at a commencement speech.
The first line after that point is what's so important. They want what is good for you. And the tension that many people and parents feel is that distinction between what's best for you and what's good for you. Now, you quoted Teddy Roosevelt. I think it was Katie Couric talking about Teddy Roosevelt. I quoted, hypothetically, Teddy Roosevelt's mother saying that, look, he wanted to go be the doer of deeds and slay rhinos and everything else. I'm fairly certain that his mother wanted him to be a doctor or a lawyer. And there is the tension, which is as a young person, you want to go out and seize whatever opportunity speaks to you, but it may be quite risky. The chances of failure are significant, particularly the more lonely the path. As a parent, and I am now a parent, so I appreciate this more, you don't want your child to end up face down in the gutter. When your child says, look, I want to be an actor, I'd like to be, to be in movies, your tendency is to say, well, honey, why don't you get a law degree and be an entertainment lawyer? Then if this doesn't work out, you'll still have a good job. And I think that's a source of tension for a lot of folks in their early 20s. One of my favorite quotes in the book is from Jhumpa Lahiri, the Pulitzer Prize winner. And she writes about her father, who is an immigrant from India and very much believes in, look, you need to provide safety and security for your family. He was a tenured professor, and she talks about how important it was when he finally got tenure because that meant security forever. And she said that when you go out and do great things like writing fiction, you kind of are leaping off a cliff, and sometimes there may not be a net there. But she tells this wonderful anecdote about how after she had won the Pulitzer Prize, her father says to her, you know, you may not always be able to depend on these stories. You should try and become a tenured professor.
We're speaking with Charles Whelan, who teaches at Dartmouth College and the University of Chicago. He's the author of 10.5 Things No Commencement Speaker Has Ever Said, and we're ticking through some of them. You encourage graduates to do something lonely and audacious, take time off, which you did, and traveled through the South Pacific, China, India, and Europe. What did that time do for you?
It did amazing things. And I should point out, this is one of the things in my 20s that my parents thought was just an absolutely horrible idea. My mother's comment at the time when I laid out the travel plans was, you're going to come back a year behind. And to which I replied, behind what? You know, is there a bell somewhere that I'm going to ring when I'm 72? Mm. So what happened is my girlfriend at the time, now wife of nearly 20 years, and I decided that we would take the year off after Dartmouth, travel around the world to the places you mentioned. We both spent about 4 months working very menial jobs to collect the cash, and then we took off. For me as a writer, I came back with clips. So for your listeners, it'll make sense. I actually wrote articles for the Valley News. I was their roving foreign correspondent in 1988 and 89, when a lot of really interesting things were going on in the world. So I came back with an appreciation for the world, a better sense of what I wanted to do, and coincidentally, a step forward in my career because I actually had some clips that I could show people to prove that I could write.
Hmm. Your wife, just checking, she's smarter than you, because that is part of your advice. Marry someone smarter than you are.
I think you could make a pretty good case that she is. She was certainly the only one in the family who was summa cum laude at Dartmouth. But the point is twofold. Actually, one's kind of funnier than the other. But the first point is, look, we don't talk about marriage for one of its most important features, which is, look, it's a really important economic tenet. And you're picking up a partner in life, an economic partner as well. So I tell the story about how when I was getting a PhD, she was able to work. When she wanted to start an internet company, I was working. So there is a certain economic yin and yang that matters a lot. The other reason I pointed out to the graduates is I said, look, it's graduation weekend. All the summa cum laude have their names in the program. it will never be so easy to identify the really smart people. You're not going to go into a health club 2 years from now and ask for a list of the 10% of the smartest people. So go out there and shoot smart fish in a barrel this weekend.
Or a fraternity basement, for that matter, I suppose.
Exactly. They probably are not wearing their Phi Beta Kappa ribbons in the basement. That would not be something I would advise.
And then there's your last point. Don't try to be great. Now that is surprising.
The advice comes from Phil Ponce, who is the host of Chicago Tonight. Right before the cameras go on, it's a live program, he leans over to the guests and he says, don't try to be great, just try to be solid. And what happens is when you stop thinking about trying to be great, you get better. It takes the pressure off. So I think in a lot of domains, everything from being athletic to pursuing writing and other tasks, if you obsess about being great, you'll be too risk averse, you'll be too nervous, and you will forego the things that ironically will actually make you great.
You know that expression, I don't know if you've ever heard it, but it makes a lot of sense to me. You don't know what you know until you know it. Have you heard that?
I have.
There are things that can only be said with hindsight. And looking back through these messages, I, you know, wonder if they're lost on the young.
I don't think so. It's certainly a reasonable question to ask. But based on the reaction to the speech and the original motivation for the speech, which we really haven't talked about, which is I wanted to tell them, the Dartmouth class of 2011, the stuff that really would have helped me when I was sitting in the very same place that they were sitting. So when you talk about things like take time off, here I was as a very lonely 22-year-old thinking, I want to go around the world, and everybody's telling me it's a bad idea, including my parents. I think if somebody had stood up who was 23 years older than me and had done that and said take time off, it really would have had a significant effect. Some of it may be lost on the young. Certainly the book has resonated with folks who are older as well. But I do think there's value in telling hard, cold truths to folks, even if it all doesn't make sense at the time.
And of course, at my high school, they said, commencement is not an ending, but a beginning.
This is exactly what I tried to avoid with my talk and book.
Well, Charles Whelan, that's what makes it a delightful book. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Charles Whelan teaches at Dartmouth College and the University of Chicago. He's author of 10 and a half things no commencement speaker has ever said, and also the best-selling book, Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science. There are clips to watch some of the commencement speeches we mentioned, and also more on Charles's book at wordofmouthradio.org. Charles Whelan's unconventional advice for graduates got us talking about the twists and turns of our own postgraduate lives. The path life takes, as we know, often zigs, as often as it zags. So I asked a few colleagues at various stages in their progression to record what they wish they'd been told on that expectant day, based on their respective real-world experiences.
First, go volunteer abroad. Build a school or dig a well. It won't have much impact on global misery, but it looks good on a resume, and you'll probably hook up.
When you figure out where you want to work, become a volunteer or intern. Insinuate yourself. Work long days for free. Show them how awesome you are. Latch on like a tick, and don't let go until you've got a job.
Don't take 1 year off after high school. Take 3 or 4. Move to California. Be irresponsible. Work menial jobs. When you're sick of living paycheck to paycheck, move back in with your parents and go to college. You'll be happy you're finally making something of yourself, and you'll be a 21-year-old freshman. You can imagine the perks.
Get all the ironic tattoos that you can. Seriously, you'll never regret them.
Figure out who's really, really good at what it is that you want to do, and then copy everything they've ever done. It worked for P. Diddy.
Figure out who's really good at what it is you want to do, then copy everything they've done. Worked for me.
Hold on to that restaurant gig for as long as possible. Try to internalize how terrible you get treated, then channel that energy into hating people right back.
Work retail. There's no better way to learn to deal with difficult people, to learn to make people happy, and to figure out that hours at any other job you do are much better than retail.
If you fear you've wasted your time in college, don't forget, you can always go back and waste more later. For now, get a job. Any job.
Producers Todd Bookman, Taylor Quimby, and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie there, imparting their commencement advice to this year's crop of graduates. I can vouch that no one recommended getting into plastics, and that they all made their parents proud. Eventually.